Welcome to the Nerd Party.
Let the filibustering begin.
Welcome to Nerd Party.
Hello and welcome to Filibuster here on the Nerd Party Network. I'm Lee Hutchison, and today I'm joined by one of Star Trek's most prolific writers and creative talents, Brannon Braga. Brannon Braga wrote for The Next Generation, Voyager, Enterprise, two feature films, Generations and First Contact, and has had an acclaimed career since, working on shows like 24, The Orville, Cosmos, Salem, and much more. In this interview, we'll dive into Brannon's creative process, the type of writer rooms he's worked in over the years, views on episodic and serialised television, working in a writing pair, moving into direction, and much, much more. Thanks so much to Brannon for joining me and being incredibly generous with his time, and I hope you too will enjoy this interview.
So obviously you're a writer, producer, creator, and director. What were kind of your early inspirations, and was it a challenge to turn that into a profession before you got your break in, say, like 1991?
Like a lot of people, I have a lifelong fascination with movies. And movies have always been my first love. I think it's for a lot of reasons that I would come to realize over the years. I think as a form of human artistic expression, filmmaking encompasses every single one of them. You know, photography, cinematography, makeup, hair, clothing, painting, acting, music, sound, color, black and white. And I'm not covering everything by a long shot. It's got it all. And I always was interested in all of the aspects of it. But the only one that I could do for free with the resources I had at growing up was writing. That was the only part of it I could do, you know. And so I really got into writing, and I really liked, wanted to learn more about how movies were written and TV shows. And I was a fan of movies than television, though I love The Twilight Zone, and I love The Andy Griffith Show. My mother was really into these British miniseries like Poldark, and some of the others at the time in the 70s and early 80s. But so you know, without cell phones or movie cameras or any way to explore what it meant to make movies, I all I had was a typewriter that my mom gave me. So I wrote stories, and I was always kind of a writer first and foremost, without even really realizing it. I mean, for the longest time, I wanted to be an actor as a kid because I thought that the actors were making up the lines as they went along, because I didn't know how movies were made. And then I found out what actors did and what writers did, and I started getting into writing from a very young age. Never really understanding how I was going to get into the business. Never really gave a second thought to it as a way to make a living or how much money people made. It was just because I wanted to do it. I think when my opportunity came in June of 1990, when I applied and got an internship that with the Academy of TV Arts and Sciences, it landed me on a show called Star Trek The Next Generation that was currently between just ending its third season. And I was ready enough as a writer, I think, to succeed in where I was placed, I guess. You know, some people say success is opportunity meets preparation. And I suppose there's some truth to it.
Obviously, you arrived through sort of an internship. How did you turn an internship into a paid role within a few months?
Well, it was an 8-week internship, and it was a paid internship, which is rare. It's a great internship program. I really just spent the 8 weeks. I mean, it was a very formative 8 weeks because I learned what it was to make television. I wasn't really even interested in TV. I wanted to make movies, but I figured I didn't even really think about writing TV or what writing for TV really meant. Other than The Twilight Zone, I knew Rod Serling's work. And boy, was I lucky that I got placed with Michael Piller, who was my mentor. And in that 8 week time, the only other writer who was there was Ron Moore. I met Ron, a lifelong friend, and all the writers were hired in that 8 weeks that would become lifelong friends I still talk to every day. Joe Manosky, Narain Shankar, and others that would form the writing staff of that particular show and would launch all of our careers. I didn't really go seek out to turn the internship into a career. I just kind of hung out and listened. I thought, you know, this would be a great way to, I love the show. I wasn't a Star Trek fan at the time, but I knew I could had something to contribute to the show. Look, I just got lucky. My mentor, Michael Piller, gave me a rewrite to do of a script that was needed to be fixed. And he put me together with Ron Moore, and we were the two youngest writers. And we did a good job. And Ron was already kind of a staff writer, and they hired me. You know, they hired me to be a staff writer. And I just worked, 17 years later, it would be 17 years before I left that building. I was there for a long time.
What was that writing room like? Because obviously you came in around the same time as the Ronald D. Moore, Renee Eshvanar, Narain Shankar, obviously under the tutelage of Michael Piller. Obviously, this was your first time being in sort of a writing room. What was sort of the dynamics and what would be like a typical day within this writer's room of kind of when, for a lot of people, they considered that season that Used Well came together being one of the peaks of the show and probably the franchise?
Well, when I first walked in the door, a couple days before Best of Both Worlds Part 1 had aired, and I watched it and thought, wow, this is really cool. I don't think anybody knew at the time how successful and how unusual for a show to do a cliffhanger other than a daytime soap opera in America was. It created quite a sensation at the time. It was just a couple days later that I walked into Michael Piller's office to meet him for the first time, and he was at his keyboard on computers that at the time only had amber-colored monitors. And I introduced myself, and he said, God, I'm trying to figure out how to beat the Borg. How do we beat the Borg? He was trying to figure out part two of that two-parter, and that was kind of my introduction was talking about that story. And luckily I just watched the episode, but there wasn't a writing staff. The writing staff would start coming together in the coming weeks. And a typical day on the writing staff of Next Generation was we would spend, usually Michael liked to write in the morning. So the mornings were writing and we'd get together to start breaking a story around noon. And by breaking a story, I mean, hey, Ron came up with an idea for a story where we are going to go to Picard's family vineyard and he's going to recover from the post-trauma of being assaulted by the Borg, violated by the Borg. And we're going to do something, we'll try to do something incredibly unusual by never going to the ship. And so we would sit down in a room and talk about the story. And start laying it out beat by beat on a dry erase board, big whiteboard. And it was my job as the intern, as the beats were being worked out and dictated, to write, you know, interior Enterprise Bridge. You know, here's what happens in the scene. We very laid out the stories in great detail that way. So a writer could go off with a roadmap. It was up to the writer to write the dialogue and bring the scenes to life and make it work. But we beat out the show scene by scene by scene from beginning to end. And it's really the only way that you could do a show like that, which sometimes, like the episodes I liked to do, were kind of science fiction, mystery, thriller, reality benders. And you can't make that stuff up as you go along. You know, like one of my, I guess, most famous episodes at the time, though I didn't know it would be at the time, was a show called Cause and Effect, which was a time travel show. There was kind of a, time travel episodes were frowned upon and all but banned by Gene Roddenberry while he was still around. And I know why, because, you know, when you think, at least at the time, you think time travel, you think go back in time to stop Hitler from being born or whatever. So I came up with this wacky time loop idea, which was kind of, and I remember sitting in the writer's room from, you know, we'd work from like 12 to 4, and we just couldn't figure out how in the hell to get out of the time loop. It took a while to figure out that it would be Data who sends a message to himself, to his positronic matrix. But it comes out as garbled and reinterpreted as a number. And that's something we figured out. It's not like that really cool twist. I didn't sit in a room in that particular case and figure that out on my own, banging my head against the wall. It was a group effort. We did it together. And that's something that perhaps was the greatest creative revelation to me about television that would reverberate throughout my entire career, which is collaboration and the whole concept of writing with people. Because writing somewhat traditionally and romantically, you think of Ernest Hemingway and a bottle of scotch and a typewriter, you know, and the loneliness of it and the pain and the struggle. Doesn't have to be that way. And it's a lot more fun and a lot more productive, I've found, collaborating with other writers. And I've been truly, truly blessed to work with amazing writers throughout my career, all the way up to now, with, you know, my most recent collaborator, who's been Seth MacFarlane.
You touched on it there, obviously, these partnerships. That's something I always associated with you. Obviously, on The Next Generation, it was you and Ronald D. Moore, then you and Joe Manosky on Voyager, and Rick Berman then on Enterprise. What were those kind of relationships like? Because you were always sort of changing partner with different series. What were those kind of relationships like, and how do you function as a pair? Did you always have to potentially evolve depending on each partner that you were with in terms of what you brought to the story and script?
It was all very instinctive and in the moment. You know, Ron and I were young. You know, we were writing our first movie, Generations, when we were 27 years old. We were both just 27 years old. Like, we were figuring out what it meant to write things, you know, like this, and I think we made a good team. And I, you know, it's tough to say. I can't really look back and say who wrote what and who contributed what. You know, I will definitely say that I probably learned a lot more from Ron than he learned from me. As a writer, I'm really grateful to Ron. He was a very patient and giving partner, and Ron is just a genius with dialogue. I don't know if I've worked with anybody who writes better dialogue than Ron. He's just terrific. I was good with some of the high concept stuff, you know, but it's hard to say. You know, usually the one thing I've always kind of insisted on in all my partnerships is being the one typing. I don't know why. Maybe it's a control thing. No, but if you find a partner who you trust, who you don't mind being locked in a room with, because that's how I like to work. I don't want to be breaking scripts up into pieces and coming back and putting them together. That's writing alone to me still. You know, I've done it, but I like to sit in a room with my partner and we just go through it word by word, line by line together. And it's great fun. I mean, and I've been so lucky to work with these writers over the years. And I've learned so much from each one of them. And it's just every time it's an enriching experience. I mean, I think of my most recent collaborators, Seth or Andruyan. Andruyan, I wrote, just finished, it's airing now in England every Monday night, by the way. The new season of Cosmos. That's a show I'm not sure one person could sit and write by themselves.
Yeah.
You know, but I was so incredibly lucky to be writing this iconic show with this woman I was a fan of for decades. I write alone. I've done plenty of writing alone, but I really prefer working with people. It's just more gratifying, and I think what ends up on the page is usually deeper. I have to mention Andre Bormanis too.
Yeah.
Like, I've been writing with him on Orville. I wrote with him on Enterprise and Voyager as well. Not so much Voyager as much as Enterprise, but you know, some collaborators I still work with.
One of your working ones was you and Rick Berman on Enterprise. And I always find that one quite interesting because, say, with Joe, Rick, Andre, that those are sort of people that come from the writing background. I always found it interesting, sort of that dynamic of the writer and then someone like Rick Berman that goes from sort of being the overseer, the kind of production side to becoming a writing partner. Was that a different sort of dynamic to the one that you'd maybe get with a Ronald and a Joe?
Well, I think Rick's a really good writer. Like Rick, you know, Rick was very involved in the development of the stories on the Star Treks. He gave a lot of notes on the scripts. He wrote a couple of Next Gen scripts, but I think he was just a little nervous. I mean, you know, he wrote two pretty good Next Generation scripts, but then he just kind of fell off it. And when Enterprise came along, been kind of writing it in all anyway. And I don't know how we just decided, let's just start writing some of these things together. But Rick's a terrific writer. He wasn't labeled as such, but Rick was very involved in the writing of these shows, just in a more indirect way.
You and Ronald D. Moore, obviously, you kind of worked on three films together, Generations, Mission Impossible 2, and First Contact. How did sort of that partnership translate to creating big screen movies? And what were kind of your memories of kind of those experiences?
My memories of those times, just busy. We were all just so many things going on. When Ron and I were doing the movies, you know, when we did Generations, we were also writing the finale of Next Generation simultaneously. When we did First Contact, he was on Deep Space Nine and I was doing Voyager. We were cross-pollinating, helping each other with those scripts as well. Like, doing a lot of stuff all the time. Same with Mission Impossible, which lasted several months. And even a couple of scripts we took on that did not get made or got rewritten. One was Freddy versus Jason for a horror movie, and one was called Area 51 for New Line Cinema. We even did a couple scripts that just didn't get it. You end up writing sometimes more than gets made. It was just busy.
with making of it all, were you still able to kind of retain that thing that you do with TV show, that you still have that kind of control over, say, a Generations or a Mission Impossible script? Or was there always was there a worry that, you know, your script could be taken away and altered or twisted? Did kind of coming from the background of the TV into the films still give you much more control?
Well, with the Star Trek scripts, we obviously had a, you know, were less fearful about being rewritten. Though, yeah, it was kind of like a hard lesson when I started writing some stuff outside the Star Trek world. That, yeah, I mean, you might be one of 17 writers on a book. So certainly I didn't really pursue aggressively a feature film career, which I suppose I could have. But in TV, you know, the writer's the boss, and not in movies, though. The director is the boss.
I'd read that you had sort of an opportunity to go and be part of the creative team that developed, say, Deep Space Nine. But obviously, you stayed with Next Generation through to the end, and then on to their movies, before going on to, say, Voyager. Was there ever a sort? Was that maybe like a sliding door kind of moment in your career of it could have gone kind of one way if you'd gone to Deep Space Nine? You might not have gone down the road into these films, and perhaps never gone even towards Voyager. Was that a kind of sliding doors moment for you?
Definitely. You know, it was. Michael Piller wanted me to come over to the staff of Deep Space Nine. I don't remember what season it was. And he's like, we think you could be our, this is his words, not mine. We think you could be our secret weapon over here. Don't know, never really knew what he meant by that. I'm not sure being a weapon or being secret is a positive thing, but I think maybe he just meant somebody who could bring some cool sci-fi ideas. I don't know. But anyway, he really wanted me to go there, and I've just felt such a strong feeling about finishing Next Generation to the end. And I didn't know at the time that I would be writing the finale with Ron. But I just had a feeling I wanted to stay. I'm glad I did, because I, you know, had a deep bond with those characters and was able to write the final two-hour episode, which turned out really good. I'm really proud of it.
Voyager's obviously celebrating a 25th anniversary this year. When you came onto the show as a writer and then a showrunner in the fifth season, what did you think at both those times the show needed, and what impact did you hope to make in first your role as a writer, then as a showrunner?
Well, it was an interesting time because Ron and I were, he was going to Deep Space Nine, I was going to Voyager. Joe Manosky went on sabbatical to Europe. While it's like a little writing family had kind of broken up a little bit, but for me, Voyager was mid stride. I mean, if Next Generation had continued into season 8, I was still the same, writing the same kinds of stories, for better or worse. And there was some criticism leveled at Voyager that it just felt like more of the same. And my feeling was, but you liked what we were doing. So why is this, in any way a creative failure? You know, it's, and perhaps Voyager wasn't different enough for some people. But I enjoyed the show. As a showrunner on Voyager, I guess what I've, right or wrong, I felt it needed to be, I felt the need after season 3 to shake things up, and that's where I got the idea for 7 of 9, the character. First Contact had come out, was very successful. The Borg were open game at that point. We made the decision to stay away from the Borg until First Contact came out. And then, you know, Voyager just needed something, a boost of some kind. And I thought the Borg were a good villain for the Voyager crew, and a Borg character on the ship would be really interesting. So that was something that was between seasons 3 and 4.
You obviously played a key role in sort of developing this character, Seven of Nine. Did you expect her to make this sort of huge cultural impact that she did? I mean, here we are 25 years on, you know, it's the character's still making waves. It's kind of part of the big campaign behind Picard as well. Did you expect something that you played such a key role in developing and kind of shaking up Voyager to have such a huge impact on the franchise altogether, really?
Well, it certainly wasn't my intention to. I mean, anything you do, I'm blown away that people still talk about these Next Generation episodes. I never could have predicted that this would be the case. With Seven of Nine, I just wanted to add a character to the mix that was going to provide a foil and a dynamic for each cast member would be unique. Everybody had their little relationship with her. I'm pleased that the character remains in the cultural consciousness. I think you have to credit Jerry Ryan with doing an amazing job. These kind of Star Trek-y characters, whether they're Spock or Data or Seven of Nine, they're hard to do believably. And she did a great job.
One of the things you were touching on there, people are still talking about, say, Next Generation episodes. I was just thinking there, I remember just before Discovery kind of dropped on Netflix around the world except America, that they released what were the most popular and streamed episodes of Star Trek from, you know, the hundreds that they have access to. And they were nearly all Voyager episodes, and they were Voyager episodes that you were involved in as either a showrunner or a writer on. Was that sort of a real badge of honor that people will sometimes talk about, oh, it's the Next Generation, the original series, and oh, there's sometimes these other shows, but that actually the people that were tuning in, you know, all these years on demand, were picking episodes that you were kind of the key kind of component on?
Was this a British poll?
Yeah, I will see if I can get it up.
Just my purely anecdotal, just my own experience, seems to indicate that Voyager was much more welcomed in England.
Oh, here's the answers. So these were the most streamed episodes and stuff from kind of, they took like all the data from Netflix around the world. So this is all strictly data. So I'll give you the 10 that some of these include your work, some don't include. Number 10 was Clues from Next Generation. Number 9 was Time and Again from Voyager. 8, Q Who. 7, Dark Frontier Part 1 and 2. 6, The Gift. 5, Scorpion Part 2. 4, Scorpion Part 1. 3, The Best of Both Worlds Part 2. 2, The Best of Both Worlds Part 1, and Endgame Part 1 and 2 was Netflix's most streamed Star Trek episode. So that's ultimately just strict data. So
a lot of Voyagers.
Yeah, which was almost a bit unexpected at the time, and that seemed that people were doing these episodes where, oh, let's watch all these Borg episodes. And I think it kind of surprised people that, you know, Voyager dominated, Deep Space Nine non-existent, no sign of the original series, that people in their homes, without any sort of influence, were going to those episodes and picking them, you know. What was that like? What's that like for you? I suppose this is you just hearing it for the first time, to know that that's your work has kind of risen to the top,
well,
I guess.
I'm very happy to hear that, because I loved Voyager, and I really felt really proud of the work on Voyager, and I had a great time writing the show. I liked the show. I just had a lot more Star Trek left in me, and I'm glad that it continued. If it hadn't been Voyager, they would have been Next Gen episodes. But it's just nice to hear, because and there's a whole generation, you know, it's just interesting, you know, I have a cousin who lives in Ohio. And he, when Voyager was on the air, he was 10 years old. You know, he was a kid. But that's his Star Trek. That's the show he watches over and over again. He doesn't watch Next Gen or any of the others. He watches Voyager. And it may be a generational thing that the people watching Netflix right now are people in their late 20s and early third to mid 30s. The people who are probably the demographic that maybe watches a lot of Netflix. And Voyager's their show because that was the Star Trek they grew up with. That may help explain it. I don't know.
You touched on it with Next Generation, that mind-bending episodes was, you know, something that you brought, and it was always quite clear. You could always pick out, oh, this is a Brannon episode. With Voyager, I always thought you were quite synonymous with big concept, big idea, almost mini movies in 88 minutes. Did you find that, say, the push of CGI sort of during the 90s really helped bring that kind of big imagination and imagery to life in a way that was harder for you perhaps in the earlier years of Star Trek to kind of go big and all kind of action adventure in a way?
No, because in fact, I wanted to do more expansive storytelling because I felt we could, and I felt, you know, anything. I was looking to do things on Voyager that hadn't been done, and that the show. And one of the things was I made a conscious effort to. I wanted to start doing these two-part, like television movies with this crew. The CGI, was not very good at that time. You know, species. There was this alien adversary we created for the Borg called Species 8472, and if you look at it, it's you know, embarrassing. It's so crude. Jurassic Park had come out, CGI was out there, but you couldn't really do it all that well on television. I don't remember what the first CGI spaceship on Voyager was. It might have been the Archer's Enterprise. I don't know if at some point they made Voyager into a CGI asset. I don't think so. Like, we were still using models, you know? Like, there's a two-part Voyager episode called The Killing Game, where Janeway and B'Elanna Torres blow up a Nazi headquarters, and that's a scale model building we blew up. Like, CGI was just not there yet.
When you got to the fifth season and you became the showrunner, what kind of writing room did you create? Obviously, you touched on how Michael Piller had created his. How did a Brannon Braga style writing room begin to take shape? And has that evolved over time?
I mean, I was lucky enough to have a certain continuity of writers. Joe Manosky was still there. Ken Biller was a writer who was there, a good friend of mine. And I tried out some new writers. I think some worked, some didn't. A couple that worked were a guy named Michael Taylor and an incredibly talented young guy named Brian Fuller, who has gone on obviously to do some amazing shows on it that he created on his own. I think that I was lucky to have my closest writing allies there. And I think if there's one thing that I've tried big writers' rooms, I've tried small. I think smaller is better nowadays. It's hard to put a room together. It's hard to find. It's sometimes a little bit of a crapshoot because you can find incredibly talented writers who just don't do well with Star Trek, which is no surprise because it's such a weird. It's a weird thing, and it depends on who's running Star Trek at the time. You know, I mean, I look at this Picard show with Seven of Nine, and I'm like, this doesn't sound like Seven of Nine. Like, why is she talking like that? But it's not my show. It's somebody else's show. And to me, these recent Star Treks, they don't sound quite right to me. Which is does not mean it's wrong. It's just someone else is running Star Trek now. And they have a, you know, Star Trek can bend many different ways.
What did you make of Star Trek Picard? It's obviously not long finished. Did you enjoy it? How did you sit with it?
I haven't seen every episode, but the episodes, you know, it's great to see those characters again. It's, you know, it made me nostalgic. Of course, I had some things lots of stuff I loved and lots of some things I questioned, but, you know, like any show. But I mean, you know, it's hard to be completely objective with Star Trek because it was such a big part of my life for so long. And so, you know, I always get a little defensive about the Federation or Starfleet being depicted as a corrupt organizations or inept organizations, because Gene was so protective of them. It's like the whole ethos of Star Trek for Gene was the humans got their shit together. Find analogies in the aliens. Find conflicts elsewhere. If you want conflict between humans, write for a different show. So sometimes I feel a little, but you know, that was a long time ago.
One thing I was thinking about kind of last year that I don't know if you had the chance to see it. There was this wonderful Deep Space Nine documentary called What We Left Behind, where they had this concept of a writer's room kind of coming back together to crack a episode one, season eight style thing. Could you ever imagine a sort of scenario where they tried something similar to that with, say, a Voyager documentary, for example, where it was yourself, you know, the showrunner with, say, your Brian Fuller's, Mike Sussman's, Jerry Taylor's, Kenneth Biller's, for example, for a day, cracking a sort of season 8, episode 1, similar to kind of what Ron and Ira Stephen Bear, etc., got to do with sort of Deep Space Nine, that seemed to kind of get fans and kind of, you know, people quite excited.
I don't think I would do that because they've done it and no one's going to do it better than they did for that documentary. It was such a great idea to do that. I'm breaking stories all the time. I kind of feel like if I'm going to exert the energy, it probably should be for something that's going to get made. I'm kind of still doing it on the Orville. I feel like I'm still telling Star Trek-styled stories. So I haven't really stopped.
You got to craft, obviously, the launch of Enterprise, and it was to be sort of your final involvement on Star Trek. One thing I think so excellent, and obviously it's great to chat with you today, is Blu-rays, whether it's The Next Generation or Enterprise, you're fantastic at these sort of self-reflecting on kind of your experiences and different ideas, etc. And those are always so rewarding for fans like myself, for people that are interested in the creative process. You know, looking back on Enterprise and your, I think, what, 17 years on the kind of franchise, what do you kind of look back on it and feel? Because Enterprise is also something similar to Voyager. It had its kind of critics at the time, but it's then continued to become something that's become popular. People love to rewatch it, are discovering it all the time. How do you look back on your time and the franchise?
It's interesting because, you know, I wish I could go back. It was a heavy-duty experience because I'd already been doing Star Trek for a long time up to that point. I've had a lot of highs. I hadn't really had... It'd been a little up and down. You know, Voyager ran 7 years, and I really loved my time on it. You know, I've said this before. I wish they'd waited, that Paramount had waited a little longer before they put out another Star Trek. I think we needed a break as creatives. I think the audience needed a break. But having said that, I put a tremendous amount of energy into that show. And it's interesting to, you know, I work with a guy named Joe Micucci, who's a producer on Cosmos, and he's a hardcore Star Trek fan, mainly Next Gen and Voyager. Next Gen, numero uno, and Voyager. He's a hardcore fan. He'd never watched Enterprise. Never once. And his dad, who was a lifelong Star Trek fan from the original series on, said, "You have to watch Enterprise. It's great. You've got 99 episodes of Star Trek you've never seen." And I remember we were sitting on a plane flying somewhere to some European location, and he watched his first Enterprise episode. And he loved it because it had the feeling of the Star Trek he liked, because the people that were running the show were the ones that were doing Voyager and Next Generation. So I think that is a microcosm that I think a lot of fans out there it's representative, that the show is being discovered or rediscovered. And I think it deserves to. It's not a bad, the show took a lot of crap at the time. But it's like, and there are some episodes that aren't good. I wish I could go back and erase the crappy episodes that didn't work out. We never set out to make a bad or lazy episode. I wish I could go back and erase some of my Next Gen work too. You know, it's weird. Television has changed. You know, when I was doing Star Trek, we did 26 episodes a season. I work in TV now where I'm doing 10 to 13 episodes. It's a very different kind of experience, you know, when you're churning, you're having to put out so much material.
Between, say, Star Trek and 24, you worked on kind of several different shows, Threshold and Flash Forward. What was that period like after kind of going from, say, the security of Star Trek to this brave new world of different televisions, different deals, and kind of getting back out there into the industry, I guess?
Well, that was a nervous, you know, I spent my entire career from the age of 25 up onward at one place, at one studio, somewhat insulated. You know, we didn't get a lot of notes on Star Trek from the studio. And if we did, Rick Berman usually fielded them. I led an existence my entire creative first 15 years anyway of my creative life where I was not representative of the world at large. And I got a real taste of reality with my first show after Star Trek, which was a short-lived CBS show called Threshold, which was an alien invasion show. And it was definitely a shock to the system. I was not used to the kinds of things that I had to deal with. But I adapted. And by the time I went to 24... I was lucky enough that Manny Coto was the one who brought me over there. And Manny Coto, of course, ran the final season of Enterprise. So I already had someone I'd collaborated with before.
I love 24. I'm actually, I've owned all the DVDs, but I recently saw it. And it's actually this week. It's on digital on iTunes for like $30 for every episode. I'm like, I can't watch them on DVD anymore. I need to be able to just stream them all in one go. So my girlfriend has just started kind of watching it for the first time with me. I watched it live as it happened. And I remembered being real excited that Manny had come over from Enterprise and then yourself, because I always considered Star Trek writers were people I would keep an eye out for. And I was really interested in their career. And I was excited by your arrival in 24. And it was at a really interesting time, I felt, because I thought season 6 of 24 was pretty poor, but season 7 for me is one of the top tier seasons, one I really enjoy kind of rewatching. What was it like coming into 24 for season 7? Because it had a kind of bumpy start because it was obviously delayed with kind of the writer's strike, and, you know, it kind of had this long process of kind of, you know, fans having to wait. What was it like for yourself kind of coming in at season 7 after kind of a difficult kind of previous season for 24?
Well, you know, I felt for, you know, first of all, 24, I was a fan before I went over. And 24 to me, I love thrillers. I love suspense. You know, my favorite director is Alfred Hitchcock. 24 is an amazing thriller. If nothing else, it's just a great thriller. And it was so, by the time I went there, I was just curious to see how they made it, because I'm like, how are they writing this? It's so complex. It has so many moving parts, but it's so clear and works so well. When I got there, though, there was a little bit of tumult just creatively, because they'd come off this amazing high of season 5.
Oh, God, I love that season.
And then this, winning all the Emmys. And then, you know, more criticized season 6, and I'm like, I've been here, you know. I just spent 17 years over at Paramount. I've had some highs and lows on the Star Trek franchise. I know, I feel for you guys, you know. So it, for me, I was just there to help, you know, to help make the show as good as it could be in, you know, my small way. But they, and I think, you know, and I teamed up with Manny, and Manny and I wrote quite a few episodes in season 7. I can't remember how many, but, you know, a lot. And for some reason, I just really loved working on that show. I loved the guys, Howard Gordon and Joel Surnow and Evan Katz and Manny Coto. I just, and there was something about the show I don't know what it was. I just really connected to it and really enjoyed working on it.
What was it like going from, say, like Next Generation and Voyager, you know, largely quite episodic, self-contained episodes, to shows like 24, where it is all, you know, arcs within several hours or season-long arcs? How do they make the sausage at 24? What's the kind of the rules, and how do they expect the writers to kind of work within it?
It's a very fluid process. I mean, to me, it was like a magic trick. I wanted to see how they did it. How are they doing this high wire act? And it's a high wire act. It is a core group of writers, you know, 6 or 7 guys, and they did something I'd never experienced before called crossboarding. They would prep and shoot 2 episodes at a time. So you had to have 2 scripts ready at a time. And you were just constantly trying to figure out where to take the various storylines and what was going to work and what was best. And just I've never spent so much time in a writer's room as I did on 24. We would be talking, you know, sometimes 8 to 10 hours a day. And writers would go off and do drafts, and you could go write a script and come back and find out that the next 2 episodes that were broken out have changed everything. And so the script you just wrote is being thrown out, and you have to rewrite it. It was that fluid. Like, things were constantly shifting. And it kind of... it was a very Socratic writer's room. You know, the final say was really Howard Gordon's and Joel Surnow, though Joel ended up leaving when I was there. But we talked out every permutation of every storyline you can imagine. Like, it just, so much thought went into it. And so really, the magic trick was just, it's really hard, long work, and lots of thinking and lots of writing and rewriting, and it was labor intensive. But it was fun. It was a really, really fun show to do.
Yeah, that fun showed really on screen. As I say, I really enjoyed a recent rewatch of season 7, and season 8's kind of up on the cards next. So yeah, I was always kind of fascinated by 24 because it was gripping entertainment, but you were always wondering, going, I just wonder how much coffee is needed in that writer's room to keep everything juggling.
It worked for the show because it was a writer's room that could be combative at times. It was just, it was funny, it was combative, it was but it was ultimately just a group of writers trying to make the best show possible, and the high wire act of the writer's room, it translated to the screen somehow. Like this was not, you know, it felt like we would write it and it would get shot almost, you know, it was very a scary process, a nerve wracking, but the nerve wracking translated well to the screen. You felt it.
Post 24, obviously, you've touched on this before, was the show Terra Nova, a short-lived show that you kind of worked on with Steven Spielberg. What were the experiences that you took from working on a show like Terra Nova and kind of brought forward into a show like Salem, that, you know, a critically acclaimed show that you kind of helped co-create as well?
Well, Terra Nova was a real learning experience. It was a show. If I took away one of my most valuable lessons that I took away from it was, well, first of all, it was a straight to series show. It was my first experience even knowing that something like that could happen. Meaning there was a pilot script that I was going to have to rewrite, and they wanted to go straight to series, which meant working on the pilot script, casting the pilot, casting the show, hiring a writing staff, writing episodes, prepping the pilot, finding locations. Normally all of those things are segregated. You make the pilot first, you get the cast right, you reshoot or recast or rejigger things. The pilot is a test phase and you get it right. And if it works, they pick it up to series, and then you have time to put a staff together and do all the things that you need to do to put a series together. This was not only all of those things had to happen at the same time. We had to build a city, a town rather, in the middle of the jungle in Australia. So there was also the added pressure of that and the distance, because my core operations were in Los Angeles. It was a major undertaking. And I'd be curious to know what was the first TV show to go straight to series. This had to be one of the first. And I took the mistakes, you know, there were a lot of, let's just say I took a lot of the experiences I had on that into Salem, which was another straight to series, build a town situations. But this time I was ready. I'd been through it and I knew, okay, that I can do this. Here's what I need to do and not do to make this happen. And you know, to a degree as well on Orville, another straight to series, build a spaceship kind of situation.
You've obviously kind of found, sort of a following on from kind of Salem as well, that you've found acclaim and awards with Cosmos. How did you become involved in sort of this new interpretation, and did you ever expect it to be this huge breakout and crossover hit with so many different generations?
Well, I was a fan of Cosmos when the original one with Carl Sagan came out. In 1980, I was in high school. I think I was 15 years old. And It changed my life. It made me realize that it introduced me to science, which I'd already had an interest in, but I didn't really understand some of the really just fundamentals of critical thinking and the scientific method and a way of seeing reality and judging reality. Like, it really influenced me. And kind of out of the blue, I was winding down on Terra Nova, not sure whether there was going to be a second season. And it came very close that there was going to be a second season. And I think that show should have run a while, because it was expensive and it was doing really well internationally. But I'm glad it didn't, because in some ways, because toward the end, I got a call out of the blue from Seth saying, "Hey, do you know the show Cosmos? I'm helping to launch a new season of it. Would you be interested in meeting with Andrew Ian and trying to help out and get it going?" And that was just a call out of the blue from Seth. And I think they needed somebody to come in and help get the show made. And that's what I did.
You've gone on to direct on Cosmos. You've graduated from producer, showrunner, writer to directing. What is a Brandon Braga director like on set? And has this been something you've really enjoyed and embraced? I never realized you'd even sort of directed a Marilyn Manson music video, which is, I need to definitely get that fired up on YouTube.
I have never directed a Marilyn Manson music video. So I don't know. I think I saw that online a while back. That's inaccurate.
I wonder wonder who would go to the effort of putting that up on the internet. That is absolutely bizarre.
Yeah, it doesn't really make sense. I do know Marilyn Manson. I've worked with him as an actor, and he wrote the theme song for Salem. But I didn't direct a music video, so I don't know where that's coming from. But just goes to show, you know, the internet's filled with stuff like that. But, you know, it's an interesting, I don't want to sound pretentious, but, you know, the auteur theory of filmmaking, which is a good enough theory, though I think it diminishes the intensely collaborative nature of the film business. But if there's an auteur in film, it's the director. And if there's an auteur in television, it's the showrunner. And that's been the case for most of scripted shows. I mean, there are some great auteurs that just are not appreciated. I'm working with a woman named Erica Huggins, whose husband is the son of Roy Huggins. And Roy Huggins was a showrunner whose list, and most people are not going to know who the hell Roy Huggins is. Who's Roy Huggins? Who cares? Well, Roy Huggins was a showrunner who created, an American showrunner. Here are the shows he created and ran: Maverick, The Rockford Files, 77 Sunset Strip, The Fugitive. And that's just, hold on a second. These are just his successful shows. His most successful shows, and Beretta, The Virginian. In other words, some of these shows I'm mentioning to you are absolutely formative, iconic TV shows. And there was an auteur behind them named Roy Huggins, who broke every story and supervised every script, wrote most of them. You know, Rod Serling, probably arguably the best known showrunning writer, auteur. It's one of the great things about running a show is and it's maybe one of the reasons it took so long for me to start directing, which was always the reason I got into this in the first place, was I kind of felt like I'm in charge of the show already. You know, why do I need to direct the show? But that's obviously not the case. Directing's a whole other thing, and I love doing it. I mean, it's a much more hands-on level of filmmaking, and it's really enjoyable. And I could have directed any number of Star Trek episodes. I just never, I don't know why, I was always too busy writing the show. I couldn't take the month off to prep and direct an episode. Like, when was that going to happen? But I'm glad that Cosmos was my first thing. It kind of made it special, you know? And I just directed my first movie that's coming out in October, but I don't have an exact date yet.
You've obviously kind of followed into Orville with writing, directing, producing. What's it like kind of on Orville? Because I know when you kind of touched on earlier of like, say, for example, when you touched on discovering Picard, going, it doesn't kind of feel like that, maybe that little bit of Star Trek. People kind of say that Orville gives that home to people that are looking for that hopeful, reassuring sci-fi, that comfort blanket, that humor. What's it been like to go to Orville and to bring such a big audience in with you? It seems to be such a wildly popular show in America and here in the UK and abroad.
Well, you know, Seth's a Star Trek fan, a Next Gen fan primarily. And Seth and I think we've been friends for almost 20 years, and we would talk about Star Trek and maybe doing a show like Star Trek. And he just, again, one of these random phone calls, I was winding down on Salem, and he's called and started talking about this pilot he had written, and called it the Orville, and would I be interested in. It was, you know, it was really, something was missing on TV, and the kind of aspirational science fiction standalone storytelling, not serialized, it wasn't around. It had gotten lost, and most science fiction was really dark and scary and depressing. This was something that just I missed, you know. I didn't ever imagine I would be telling these kinds of stories again. And when I was a bit nervous about it, you know. But then I, like, my God, I have so many ideas that could only be done on this kind of show. And what a delight to be back on a spaceship.
Is it kind of exciting to, as you say, you've got these opportunities to inspire a generation through sort of kind of darker times, that it almost reminds me, I can see parallels between this and the Next Generation, not in terms of, you know, people involved in front of and behind the camera, but in terms of, there was a show, it had this first season that people were maybe checking out, weren't too sure, and then it's continued to build and build, and it's kind of flourishing on a new network as well. Is it kind of exciting to see almost history repeat itself in a, you know, a different way again in the future, that this kind of show is thriving and continuing to bring in audiences and become more and more popular with each season as kind of word of mouth spreads?
Well, it certainly was. It was both nerve-wracking and gratifying. I mean, I remember, look, there are the aesthetics of Orville in terms of a starship you would want to spend time on, definitely is a nod to the Next Generation. It's you know, the Next Generation spaceship, that show was just so groundbreaking. It didn't look like any ship you'd ever seen. It had carpet, you know, it was comfortable. And that was a really conscious choice by Gene Roddenberry, who's like, this is a ship with 1,000 people, including families and children. And like, this is a place you live. So it's got to be comfortable. And we brought that aesthetic with us. And the type of storytelling, the allegorical standalone storytelling, was definitely a nod to Star Trek. But, you know, the thing that's really, I think I can speak for Seth, that we were nervous because it was not what people were going to, it was not Spaceballs, or it was not Galaxy Quest. It's not Family Guy in space. The stories are really dramas first and foremost, and that's how we conceive and break the stories. The humor is the icing on the cake. And if you watch the show evolve, probably the goofiest of the episodes is episode one, the pilot. There was an episode three, one of the ones I directed, about a sex change that forcible sex change that occurs, a gender alteration. It's quite a dramatic episode that we pulled up in the air date order because we were like, we have to be honest with the audience that this is really what this show is. There's some funny in it, but at the core, it's a pretty serious drama with a kind of a tragic ending, bittersweet tragic ending. And let's see if they're going to go for it, because we didn't know. And I remember when the reviews started coming out, some of them were pretty brutal, the critics. But then I remember when the show started airing, I could tell the fans were liking it. I could tell the audience was liking it and accepting it. And that acceptance of its more dramatic nature freed us, liberated us in seasons two and really in season three, which we're shooting now, to really embrace the drama of it all.
I'm reminded there when you talk about that third episode, that was when I noticed a change in sort of people's thing, that there was this talk, oh, this is a show, yeah, I'll give it a shot. And then there was a lot of people going, you need to check out this third episode. This is different from what we expected. And it seemed to get people really excited, and it seemed to be the word of mouth episode that people would go, check out that third episode and you'll be convinced to kind of go along with the Orville and give it your time. I think that was a really clever decision.
Well, yeah, I mean, it was a little bit of a battle, you know, because the studio, I think, and network, they were promoting the show, and they were promoting it very well, but they were promoting it more as a screwball comedy. And it was, I know, a little frustrating for Seth, it's like, that's not what the show is. You know, the show's something a little different. And it just took some time, but not a lot of time, I was surprised. I think it was at New York Comic Con. We'd only aired five episodes, and the venue at Javits was sold out. It was standing room only, thousands of people, and many of them in uniforms. I don't even know where the hell they got these things. We'd only aired five episodes. So the response was pretty great. Now, you know, a lot of that's, you know, Seth's following, and the show is just so well executed, and that's really, it's really Seth's vision.
Did it kind of vindicate you? You kind of touched on that some of the work you'd done, whether it was Voyager or Enterprise, had come in for sort of criticism for, you know, oh, it's episodic. This is, you know, these are, we want kind of more serialized, we want darker, we want edgier. To then sort of years later to have that style of show be embraced so well and to bring upon fans and critics that had maybe previously said, nah, this is an old way of presenting a show, we want this, for them to maybe come round and realise how important that kind of hopeful and something that people can kind of watch with all family members, I guess.
I feel, look, it's a more complex discussion, you know, what the nature of serialized storytelling versus standalone episodic storytelling. But I like episodic storytelling. You know, endings are an important part of a story. And it was one of the challenges for me in 24, which was, you know, the shows had to have a climax and a pseudo ending. Like, it had to feel like an ending. But I wonder if a show like 24 is going to have the rewatch factor that Star Trek has because of its serialized nature. You know, you can look back at an episode and say, oh yeah, that's You know, you can say, here are my top 10 favorite Star Trek episodes. Can you do that with a highly serialized show? Can you point to the one where the time loop or whatever it was? I'm not sure. I think it's great to have a story that has a beginning, middle, and end. And, you know, we got accused all the time on Star Trek of, you know, reset button. You're lazy. There are no consequences in the next episode. And I'm like, that's not what the show is. You know, if a reset button is a negative way of putting it, but it just, I don't know.
Let's say we go back to earlier, the Netflix data perhaps bears out that theory that people want the episodic ones. Those are the ones that, you know, as you say, a 24 or a serialized one, do you dive into a middle episode? Do you dive into the climax something? Or do you dive into these 44-minute mini movies or adventures or romps and go, you know what, that's what I want, that beginning, middle, and end of a Dark Frontier or an Endgame, something like that. You know, we can debate and discuss it, but I suppose the Netflix data and the algorithms and the number crunchers kind of perhaps bear out that's what people want at home, I guess.
I don't, you know, look, the most popular show, scripted shows on TV, I would imagine, I don't have data in front of me, are some of these Law and Order type shows that have been running forever. You know, they don't get the covers of magazines necessarily, but they sure as hell work. I really love sitting down in a room with the Orville writing staff and with some new idea and rolling up our sleeves and telling a new story. And it's just, I don't know. I like it. That's the kind of, I like it a lot. And I think there is plenty of serialization going on for my taste. I mean, just enough, if you ask me.
You touched on it that you've got your first directorial feature coming up in the future. Can you tell us a little bit about that and what else people might be able to look forward to in the near future from you? I know this is a difficult time to pin down dates or any kind of announcements at the moment. Is there anything you can perhaps tease and give us a little heads up on?
It's called Books of Blood, and it's based on is an English author named Clive Barker, who published in the 1980s, he published this multi-volume set of stories that called Books of Blood, short stories, horror, kind of fantastical, psychological horror, that had a massive impact on me. And we have developed an anthological film with multiple cross-secting stories in it. Kind of like the best example I can use, it would be like Pulp Fiction, you know. Stories that stand alone but cross-pollinate in little ways. Not comparing the two, you know, obviously. I could only hope to be in a fraction as successful as Pulp Fiction, but it's a fun movie and hopefully scary and hopefully psychologically intriguing. And the screenplay is written by Adam Simon and Clive Barker and myself. Adam was my creative partner on Salem. And it was a really good script and it was fun to make. And it's coming. I know the plan is for it to come out in October for Hulu. And that is, as far as I know, still happening.
Excellent. Obviously, we're in a lockdown right now. I'm curious, what have you been watching, reading, listening to that you would maybe recommend people to maybe check out? Or are you deep in post-production and still kind of working away hard?
No, everyone's home. No one on the Orville's shut down. My movies post-production is shut down. I'm able to do some writing and stuff. You know, I'm doing, like most people, a lot of reading, kind of looking around for new projects, reading some books that haven't been published yet. I am embarrassed to say what I've been watching on TV, mainly really junky TV. Like, you know, like everyone else, I watch The Tiger King.
I've still got one episode to go on that. So yeah, I'm nearly there too. I think we're all kind of desperate for that sort of junky TV right now. Something that's just easy and reassuring, I think.
Yeah. Yeah. But, you know, the best piece of TV I've seen in a long time that I finally sat down and watched the whole thing was Chernobyl. I think it's an absolutely amazing 5 hours of television. And I watched The Outsider on HBO, another HBO show, which was based on a Stephen King novel, kind of a horror, police procedural horror thing. I just watch a lot of movies. I like, you know, I miss going to the movies.
Yeah, I'm pining for that every day at the moment.
I can't wait to go see the new Bond picture because I'm a huge James Bond fan.
Yeah, me too. Who's your favorite Bond? If we can sort one thing out on your Wikipedia, you didn't direct to Marilyn Manson, but if they had it as your like IMDb trivia or something, Brandon Braga's favorite James Bond is.
Well, I have to say, I'm a big fan. I'm such a fan of James Bond that, I like them all for different reasons, but I think my favorite Bond is Connery. And I have to say that, yeah, I mean, Connery is my favorite Bond, but Daniel Craig's pretty awesome too. And he's the closest in spirit to Connery, but I grew up with Roger Moore. So I have a soft spot for Roger Moore's Bond. Was a little bit of a lighter Bond. I could go on and on.
Did you expect when you were an intern that years later you would still be, you would be stuck in a global pandemic, stuck in your room chatting about working on Star Trek with someone in Scotland?
Never in a million years. Could never have predicted that. But I'm glad I have something to talk about.
Well, thank you honestly so much, Brandon. It's been such a pleasure to chat with you. And I hope you and your family and those near to you are all safe and well in the coming weeks. And good luck with your film. I'm really looking forward to it.
Cool. Thank you. Thanks for your interest. It was fun.
Join the revolution. Join the Nerd Party.
Welcome to Nerd Party.